Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 28, where we're discussing yet another Journal of Management Studies classic, this time by Mads Allison, focusing on a paper from 1993, Organizations as Rhetoric. To get links to the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
And I'm Ella, coming to you from Sydney in Australia.
My name is Mads Allison. I'm working at Lund University, Sweden.
So welcome, Mads. It's an absolute pleasure that you've found the time to join us, and we're super happy to have you here with us.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
For those of our listeners who may be unfamiliar with Mads, you should be familiar with him. But a brief intro is that he is, as he just mentioned, at the Lund University in Sweden, but also, as I understand, partly at Queensland Business School in Australia. He's done extensive research and published widely in many areas, including methodology, critical theory, organizational culture, knowledge work and knowledge, which is what we're discussing today, as well as identity, gender, and a whole bunch of other stuff related to professionals. He published widely with leading publishers and has many, many articles under his belt. And you may not know this, but we've actually touched upon one of his books back in episode 15 when we had his co-author Jörgen Sandberg discuss a fascinating work on constructing interesting research questions. So despite not being on the podcast before, we have discussed your things previously, Mads, which is, I think, just a sign that this is long overdue. So before we get into the content, I think it might be worth giving a brief introduction to what it is that we're talking about today.
Sure. So I might just give us a brief overview of the paper. And this paper from 1993, it's really in the vein of what Mads is known for, which is sort of skeptical research, which I really appreciate about your work, Mads, that you are reflecting on mainstream ideas and really going a little deeper to figure out what we're actually talking about. And so in this paper, Mads observes that we're all talking about knowledge work and knowledge workers and knowledge intensive firms. And we talk about these things as if they were special and different and in some sense maybe more valuable than other forms of work. But what do these terms actually mean? There's a real question mark around that, and that's what Mads investigates in the first half of the paper. So professions used to be marked by higher education and exclusivity, but now there are many jobs that are termed professional. And it's not just formal knowledge that seems to be the most important aspects of performing this work. Who has and needs more knowledge, Mads asks, a bus driver or a heart surgeon, a doctor or a nurse? And especially once you consider practical knowledge, that becomes a really difficult question to answer. So what sets knowledge-intensive firms apart? Mads mentions that management consultants have reported that their form of knowledge is defined through flexibility. They can deal with ambiguity and uncertainty. They can learn quickly and apply knowledge that was necessary for a task. But here, success is not really dependent on the knowledge itself, but it's rather around appearing knowledgeable that's valued. It's the talk about knowledge that brings success. And so that brings about an insight that knowledge serves as what Mads calls an institutionalized myth. It is a rationality surrogate in knowledge-intensive firms. So here, legitimacy rather than efficiency becomes the goal. And in this sense, knowledge workers are seen as language workers, which is where this idea of rhetoric comes in very strongly. So an interesting point that I found you made, Matt, is that knowledge depends on recognition. So in some senses, there's no good having expertise if you're not recognized as being an expert. So that social construction of knowledge requires ongoing effort, and it's achieved in many ways through rhetoric. And that reminded me quite a lot of academic work. So down the track sometime today, perhaps we could talk about how this paper relates to academic work. But perhaps before we go there, Mads, do you think you could tell us a little bit about how you came to write this paper? What inspired it? Was there a mystery in your language that you were pursuing? Could you tell us a bit about the origins of this paper?
that time, beginning of the 90s, knowledge became very hot as a topic. In Sweden, somebody published a book called The Knowledge Firm, and this was like a huge bestseller, and everybody wanted to be the knowledge company or knowledge intensive firm. So a big fuss about that. But the problem is, and a lot of academic work also focusing on knowledge as the key resource for companies. And all this sounded quite impressive and nice, but when you start to think about what do people actually mean by knowledge, it's quite unclear, and also a lot of experts that can't really define it. So it becomes, as a concept, quite slippery and vague. When you study knowledge-intensive firms, that is firms that praise themselves to have special knowledge, expertise, and therefore clients or customers, they should pay a lot of extra money for this expertise. It's often a bit unclear exactly what are they doing. Do they, if you take IT or management consultancy, do they offer something very distinct in terms of sophisticated knowledge, based on long, good higher education, perhaps, or a lot of practical experience, and then systems within the company that make it possible for them to really do something that is extraordinary. But if you compare that with what people actually are doing, in many cases, sometimes people are just adding additional resources. So it sometimes borders on the case of grey labor. You have a lot of additional troops coming in and doing work that is not necessarily that extraordinary or expertise guided, but something else. And for these two reasons, the difficulties in defining knowledge, and then the uncertainties what actually a lot of people claiming to be knowledge workers or knowledge in, belonging to knowledge intensive firms, what they actually are doing. It's quite ambiguous and vague, and you can't really pinpoint knowledge. I mean, in some cases, it's quite clear that people have some extremely superior knowledge about the particular issues. But in many cases, it's quite vague. So what consultants do, what advertising people do, what HR experts, recruiters, perhaps even lawyers and a lot of other professions really do, it's a bit uncertain exactly how much do they offer and what is the essence of this knowledge concept that people like to use. So I started to think about these issues, and one key element here is the ambiguity of knowledge as such, and also a lot of the knowledge talk that people produce in order to present the work and themselves and the companies in a very credible way. So the ambiguity aspect around knowledge is something that I like to emphasize. And the key issue here with knowledge, I mean, everything could be knowledge, but normally the term is used when there's a complex issue, or an issue that is kind of presented or seen as complex. And if you have complexity, then you also have ambiguity. And this, for me, as I said, is a key kind of quality or aspect around knowledge work, knowledge intensive companies.
So you observe that the knowledge is ambiguous insofar as organizations and people in organizations define it. And this is actually a recurrent theme that was mentioned when we had Bill Starbuck on a couple of episodes ago, that he seems to have had a similar catalyst for his work. But then it seems that throughout this work you re-emphasize the ambiguity of knowledge and detract from the more traditional kind of objectivist or realist views of knowledge.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of like objectivistic or essentialistic stuff dominating. Well, knowledge may be uncertain and a bit vague, but it's there somehow. We can't just simply define it, but it's still the essence, the core of what a lot of companies are doing. And of course, to some extent, I wouldn't dispute that. But around this possible core or essence, there's an enormous amount of uncertainties and ambiguities. And I probably would say, if you compare the different elements, something that people actually do know and are able to accomplish, and all the kind of vagueness, diverse views, the construction processes around that, I would emphasize more heavily the centrality of ambiguity and the difficulties to reduce that very significantly in a large number of different types of occupations and companies.
Because knowledge is a very tricky concept, isn't it? I mean, even on an individual level, let alone on a collective level, it always seems to be, or it seems to have been for most of its history, connected to some kind of a truth fundamentally. So, I mean, there's the standard Plato's definition of true justified belief, but then we have people like Nozick saying that it should be tracking the truth, or who was that? Kirkham suggesting that knowledge requires evidence to become truth. In that way, kind of a more social constructivist perspective. But how far is it meaningful to establish or claim any kind of a truth value to things that organizations do? And you do cover this in the paper a number of times, suggesting rhetoric as one of the mechanisms that kind of defines the truth value of what organizations do or groups of people do in their work, in their professions.
Yeah, no, so when you are studying companies, I think that, I mean, it's partly a choice what you are interested, but it's also partly a methodological issue. What actually can you study? And what can you say something sensible about? And often when you do studies, you interview people and they talk about what they do, their competence, their knowledge, their accomplishments, and so on. In many cases, I would say that it's a bit difficult to go much further than that and say that their knowledge claims, they actually reflect some truth about their own work and accomplishments. So for me, partly for methodological reasons, I say this is something that we can study, the rhetoric or the claims or how people deal with issues around and in many cases uncertainties and contested nature of a lot of knowledge. I mean, we're not talking about very kind of simple and clear-cut processing of information. We normally are talking about complex issues where it's not so obvious what people are doing, what they're accomplishing, what is the value of this possible knowledge, and so on. So in that case, I think that looking how people are handling and dealing with these uncertainties about what they are doing and so on, also from a methodological point, makes a lot of sense. And sometimes rather speculative to just take claims about what people are doing at face value and then assume that behind these claims there is some kind of truth there somewhere. And perhaps I should add to your description here of different views of knowledge from justified beliefs and so on, more objectivist view to more social constructivist view. We could perhaps add Foucault as well, who claims that the problem with knowledge is not necessarily if it reflects the truth or not. The problem with knowledge is that it creates the truth. So a lot of the knowledge that one is interested in, it has truth-creating effects, like leadership knowledge, HRM, strategy knowledge, and so on. So it's not necessarily that it reflects reality particularly well, but it's part of corporate reality that people are using strategic management knowledge or a lot of psychological tests in recruitment, and there's an enormous amount of leadership development and presentation of leadership ideas and so on. So you have like truths or knowledge around all this, and whether it kind of reflects or says something that's relevant about the pre-existing reality is quite uncertain. But you can see that these are very much part of what people are doing in organizations, and they create a lot of consequences, also ambiguous consequences. But truth-creating effect is quite important, and I think for me this is a key element around why should we be a bit more hesitant in accepting objectivist notions of knowledge, and then look more, this is like social phenomena where people are working with what they claim to be knowledge, and there's a lot of statements or claims about this that is quite crucial for this possible knowledge to have to have some kind of impact on corporate life and the performances of companies.
Well, it certainly resembles a lot more belief rather than knowledge when it's considered as a function of what a group of people locally sort of derive to do and derive their truth to be, whether it's a function of power or a function of what it is that they actually do. And this, I think it's been a persistent question throughout management theory. Even the contingency theory, I think, can be interpreted as dealing with this fundamental issue of understanding the environment and understanding how the organization fits with that environment. And I do think that the introduction of Foucault and his notions of power as constructing and generating truth are very important, and it's certainly a significant contribution of your work. Thinking about rhetoric, though, and as a mechanism by which these truth values or knowledge claims are established or supported, did you mean by rhetoric, or kind of do you generally lean towards it as a some particular type of rhetoric, like, for example, the Aristotelian logos, ethos, pathos type of thing, or just the general discursive construct that organizations and powerful actors within organizations engage in?
Yeah, no, I'm using this in a relatively broad sense. And in general, I think I really believe in an age of persuasion, where, of course, part of the economy, part of what people are doing is very kind of materially anchored, and it depends on, and there are particular products or services that are being produced that can be assessed. But a larger and larger part of the workforce and more companies, they are into something that is a bit quite vague and ambiguous. And here it's very important then to convince other people, the market, but also internally in companies, that we have something to offer. And here, a variety of means then for persuasion is quite significant. So we have this enormous interest in branding, lots of talk about visions and values, corporate cultures. We have specific rhetoric in sales talk or other types of promotions, but you also use material objects, corporate buildings. Sometimes train people in terms of how should they talk, how should they appear, how should they be dressed and develop identities. So the interactions with others are very convincing in terms of we stand for something, we have something to offer. This immaterial quality, knowledge, competence, unique organizational cultures, innovative capacity, or whatever. It rather seldom speaks for itself. You can't easily demonstrate that we have creativity, innovation, customer adaptation, fantastic good analytical capacity, and so on, that you can offer to clients or customers. But in order to make it all work, and also to reduce your own doubts in terms of what you are doing, then this mobilization, a lot of rhetoric, materially anchored or supported by different types of symbolic actions, etc., are quite vital. And it's, in that sense, rhetoric in the broad sense of the word, where passions, where logic are part of all this. But the general mobilization of a lot of persuasive resources to convince others, and often to convince yourself that you have something to contribute with, is quite common. And this is consultancy firms, but also institutions like higher education, like universities. I mean, it's rather difficult to point exactly what does a business school contribute with more than all this enormous amount of persuasive talk and people picking up language and models that they can communicate, and then they can give the impression that they really are knowledgeable and worth much higher wages than others, for example, after an MBA, something that a lot of people criticize quite heavily, but it's still there. It's like a resource for people's persuasive work in their careers.
So, Mats, I mean, even thinking about those questions can get a little uncomfortable. And in other work, you've also mentioned that these are existential questions around what is it that we're all actually doing here with our work. if we're not producing something meaningful, if we're just working on rhetoric to appear knowledgeable or to try and persuade. How do you go about talking to people about this and interviewing people without just, I don't know, prompting existential crises where people are breaking down and can't go on with their work? Is there a way in which we can access these sort of issues without totally pulling the rug out from people?
Yeah, no, I think that is a dilemma. We all need our life lies. And I've written extensively about, together with Anders Bice, some functional stupidity in organizations, mm-hmm. where we preserve some positive notion of what we are doing, partly because we are not thinking through this particularly carefully. What am I actually doing? What's the meaning or purpose of all this? What do we accomplish? So in some cases, then there is this possible existential crisis waiting if you too seriously think about issues. I do think at the end of the day, it's much better to try to encourage these more critical questions and then try to encourage people to think through what they're doing and perhaps try to avoid then some of the traps that contemporary working life is suffering from, like too much engagement in this hollow rhetoric with excellence and high quality and jumping on fashions and a lot of sweet talk that dominate too much. I think that sometimes people can do a much better work and also perhaps feel that they're doing something meaningful if they have more critical questions about what they do.
Well, it seems that rhetoric is primarily needed where there is an environment of competing legitimacies and competing purposes for knowledge or anything else related to what we're talking about here. So I was just thinking that as Ella was talking about the existential crises, that maybe if work wasn't such a prevalent and dominant part of the professional's existence, there wouldn't be a need for an existential crisis, given that you know, it's the function of competition that that generates the need for rhetoric as much.
Yeah, I mean, there is a crowded or even overcrowded market when it comes to work that is, say, debatable when it comes to meaningfulness and accomplishment. And here, things like business goods, more and more resources are put into producing a nice image to make this really impressive, manipulating internal factors in order to come out as possible, as good as possible in terms of rankings, whatever. Much resources are sometimes spent in buildings that gives a nice appearance. People are doing an enormous amount of research, pumping out more or less meaningless articles in the right journals, but this looks really good. And you know a lot of things here in order to create not only legitimacy, but create an impression of grandiosity. This school or this company is so fantastically impressive because it spends so much time and resources and energy in looking good, looking much better than others. And this is not particularly type of sensible priority if we look at what institutions such as business schools or universities actually should accomplish. It should be about substantive learning and qualification, critical thinking, personal development, not being excellent in production of images or persuading people that you are fantastically good because you have a degree from this university without that much of a substance. So legitimacy is one aspect of this, but it also goes beyond that, because I think that a lot of people are into grandiosity, and that's not through accomplishment. It's more through pumping up your ego, pumping up various support for a fantastic image of your own occupation or company, and that's not particularly productive in terms of accomplishing something that is socially good, of course debatable, but still I insist on this being that possible objective or guiding force for organizations.
Well, business schools, I think in that sense, are a good representation of what you described when you were talking about agency as embodied in rhetoric, because business schools were established explicitly, you know, as a form of educational institution to professionalize the managerial class. So the rhetoric and the purpose of rhetoric was there from day one, and it may even be considered as impressive that they still go on to engage in this rhetoric even almost over 100 years later, since the advent of scientific management and all those establishing theories. So with that respect, the rhetoric is essentially what business schools do, and that is how they establish the identity of their students and future managers and people engaged with that sort of activity within organizations. So I suppose it shouldn't be too surprising that rhetoric is somewhat hollow with respect to management and with respect to how we understand organizations and what they do, because this is where it's coming from. It's an explicit exercise in establishing something that wasn't there before and making it desirable and overly legitimate, and all the things that came with establishing this class from essentially a pool of engineers back in the day.
Yeah, no, I think that is one key aspect. But I also think that particular part of the work or the logic of business schools that has expanded and become much more significant and even dominating today. I think in the start, it was probably a bit more kind of technical and knowledge-based, in one sense of the word, and while gradually with enormous competition and this surplus of various claims then for we having expertise or we stand for something. Here then business schools has become much more characterized by various types of arrangements and then rhetoric then signaling their excellence and their particular position in this overcrowded field. Organizations very much into them providing excellence and producing the best and the brightest and various kinds of loose signifiers that the people coming from this business school, they have something really extraordinary to offer in terms of brightness and ability. So in most cases, it's extremely hollow.
I think that word hollow is quite interesting and maybe worth exploring a bit further, because it seems to imply that there is another option, which is that there is something with substance, which may well be correct, but it does bring up questions of authenticity and what that actually means, what it means to have a substantial contribution. Does it mean that one can actually be knowledgeable rather than just present as knowledgeable? And I particularly have been reminded of the notion of impression management from the sociologist Irving Goffman. And, you know, he talks about performance as a metaphor for everyday life. It's influential work from the 1950s, but he's not saying that this is something that happens occasionally, that some people in some circumstances perform. He's saying that this is how we fundamentally engage in social life. We support each other in these impressions that we create. We support each other in these performances. And yes, we might have times when we're out of character, but we are still always known in terms of our role that is social, that requires this construction of image and to receive legitimacy within a particular sphere.
And that's all for part one of episode 28. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the discussion. And if you are, please share the podcast with your friends, colleagues, or students. And also, if you get a minute, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever else you might be listening. I'd like to remind that we now have a newsletter that's coming out every Wednesday and featuring lots of very cool things that you might be interested in, and the only thing you need to do to subscribe is just go to our website, scroll down, and enter your email. No other information is involved. Also, we have just recorded a special episode from the Organizational Learning, Knowledge and Capabilities Conference in Valladolid, Spain, and special thanks go to the organizers. That will be released later in summer after we finish the 8 GMS Classic articles. If you are attending any of the large So please join us next week as we continue with the conversation and proceed to part 2 of episode 28 with Mats Alvesen here on Talking About Organizations.